Hey, where are you going, Jim? The elevator's over here.
Taking the stairs.
But our meeting's up on 8.
Yeah, I know.
But that's 8 floors up. That's like 8 times... 8, I don't... A lot of stairs.
That's the point. I've already lost a few pounds and earned almost $100 in wellness incentives.
Whoa, you're getting rewarded for working out?
Yeah, I know. I'm just as surprised as you are, Bob.
Fearless is full of surprises. That's the power of the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Federal Employee Program. Learn more about our healthy benefits and sign up at fepblue.org/chooseblue by December 11th.
Welcome to Locked On Eagles, your source for the best Philadelphia Eagles news and analysis. I'm your host, Michael Kist. You can follow my work at Inside the Pylon, Breaking Football, and Grandstand Sports Network. You can also follow me on the Echo Chamber of Twitter at Michael J. Kist. That's K-I-S-T. I am here, as always, with my co-host, Benjamin Solak of NDT Scouting and Bleeding Green Nation. You can follow him on Twitter at Benjamin Solak. That's S-O-L-A-K. Ben, how you doing, brother?
Every day is a good day to be alive, my friend. Nothing better than a nice New York Giants loss on Monday Night Football. Of course, as we will traditionally do every Sunday or Monday, this is just your weekly reminder that people thought the Giants could win this division. Didn't understand it preseason, still don't understand it now.
We had Jimmy Kemsky on this show a couple of weeks ago, and he picked the Giants to win the division, and you were upset by it. And I think we're starting to see why. They were absolutely incompetent tonight. Not just the tackle play, which we're going to get into for sure, but also in different game situations, basically giving up. And then when you decide to go for it on 4th and 2 at the goal line, not able to get the playoff, you get a delay a game and you're forced to kick the field goal and weren't able to recover after that, after looking the best you had all game, completely not capitalizing on the momentum. Ben, what takeaways did you have from this game?
We talked about this a little bit before the season where I was speaking about why the Giants as a division champion just confounded me. We've seen so many coaches come and go in this league, coming in with schemes that say, okay, I'm going to play a certain way that will nullify my need for like this position, right? Like how many times did we hear that, like, you know, Chip Kelly, you could just insert anybody in the offense and it would work, right? With Ben McAdoo, it's always been this narrative of, okay, the offensive line is garbage, but the way I run my system, the ball comes out so quick, I don't need a good offensive line. I don't need good offensive tackles. That's been the storyline with McAdoo's offense. It doesn't work. There's no Bill Belichick. Maybe you can have a conversation about this, but you'd be very hard pressed to find a scheme. Oh, maybe Kyle Shanahan too with the quarterback, just because Shanahan's a genius. Now I'm thinking about it, but it's very difficult to find a scheme where you don't need NFL caliber starter players at premier positions like offensive tackle. And that's what McAdoo's trying to facilitate here. I mean, we were talking about it before the show. They're starting right tackle who got injured, Bobby Hart. I was watching the Cowboys and the Giant tape before this game, getting ready for the Eagles and the Giants in week 3. And Bobby Hart is just awful at tackle. Like, I don't understand how you possibly could have thought he'd be a good tackle. And so I'm going to look back to see where Bobby Hart came from. And in 2016, he was the Giants' backup guard. He wasn't even a starting guard who then played tackle. He was on their depth chart as their backup left guard and right guard. And now he's starting at right tackle? What do you think's gonna happen? I mean, it's just awful. And the Giants are this classic example of, we think that we can get by without linebackers and without offensive tackles. We think we can get by because our defense, you know, hides these positions and our offense hides those positions. At the end of the day, good teams are going to beat you. And for the Giants, decent teams are beating them. I mean, the Lions aren't that terrifying, are they?
No, I don't believe so. I mean, they haven't shown that they're some perennial team that you necessarily have to be so concerned with. And like you said, even with the linebackers too, it was clear as day that Eric Ebron was going to be open for most of the day as well, and was often and early in the game as well. So yeah, they're complete. Okay, fine. You want to get rid of the ball every two to three seconds when you drop back. Teams are going to key on that, and eventually you're going to have to block for more than 2 seconds. Period. End of story. And Eric Flowers not getting it done against Ziggy Ansah, then not giving him help. You come out in the second half, okay, on second down, you don't chip. You get a sack, and then on third down, you chip him with Evan Engram. Okay, so you already had the idea that you needed to help. So you don't help on second down. You do it when the drive is already dead. Ben McAdoo, I hope, is not going to lose his job. I want him around forever.
Oh, true. Absolutely. Be unnecessarily resilient, Ben McAdoo, with the new hairstyle too. Oh, freaky, man. He looks like my gym teacher from eighth grade or something, just scary like that. Ugh.
So, okay, moving on to the other NFC East teams this weekend. We got to talk about the Denver Broncos and the Dallas Cowboys because Denver stomped them.
And your boy, Trevor Siemian, man.
looking fantastic once again, proving why, you know, he got me to the Scouting Academy Prove It Championship. So look, 42-17 for the Broncos, and the Cowboys gave up. They just gave up. The running game wasn't working, and Ezekiel Elliott looked like a child. So there was a play, and if you haven't seen it, I'm sure you can find it somewhere. Dez Bryant drops like a slant or a dig or something like that, and an interception happens right by Ezekiel Elliott. I believe it was Chris Harris Jr. is running around for the next 7 to 8 full seconds, and Ezekiel Elliott is standing there with his hands on his hips watching it all go down, and then goes to the bench and sulks like a little baby. What is going on in Denver? Because I guarantee you, Garrett or Jerry Jones are not going to get on his case about it. They're just going to, the Cowboy way is just to kind of let it go. You know, Dez Bryant can push a show, or I'm sorry, Greg Hardy can push a special teams coach. Dez Bryant can do all this freaky antics on the sideline and no one will say boo to them. What is going on with Dallas, and can Zeke get right?
So here's when because I've gotten a little bit into the Dallas tape, like I said, previewing the Giants, and then having watched that Denver game. Firstly, I'll say that we said that we didn't expect a Dak regression, but he definitely doesn't look as sharp as he did. And I don't know, there's not too much I can say to attribute that fall off to, but he's been inaccurate, he's been high, he's been a little bit jumpy, and I mean, you know, maybe it's just coming out and feeling like the offense is more in his hands or whatever, but he hasn't looked as sharp as he has. Now, I think he'll settle in, but so you've got that Dak that's not going too well. You've got what I think that there was a big push by like a lot of like Dallas beat reporters that I follow on Twitter and just the Dallas kind of media in general saying, listen, there's not, this isn't a problem. You know, new left guard because Ronald Leary's gone, new right tackles because Lyle Collins is now there after the retirement of Doug Free, was it? Doug Free retired? Correct, yeah. And watching the tape, there's a clear drop off. I mean, it at least in continuity, and obviously there's a talent drop off as well, but continuity is one of the big issues. You know, just seeing that the way that line communicates. I mean, sure, like Travis Frederick and Zach Martin double teams are still one of the sexiest things I've ever seen on a football field, but the offensive line working as a 5-unit team isn't where it once was. Again, something that I think that time is going to help solve for Dallas, but it doesn't look as good as it did. What really interested me a lot about the Dallas-Denver game, and especially the narratives coming out of the game, was this message coming from Denver of, listen, we knew that if we put the game in Dak's hands, that Dak wouldn't be able to beat us. And I think there's a little bit more to it than just trash talking. I think that that's, you know, obviously Denver with an excellent secondary in the no-fly zone, simply saying, we don't think Dak has the placement and the anticipation and the pre-snap work and the arm talent in general in order to be a premier secondary. And a lot of the response, you know, that you've seen from Dallas fans has been like, oh, well, you know, Denver matches up against us perfectly because they have this secondary and they can do this with their front seven and so on and so forth. The response to which is simply, yeah, but if you want to be a playoff team, you got to beat those teams. You know, like right. They match up against you perfectly. Well, yeah, like good teams are going to do that because they're going to be good in a lot of places and they'll be able to schematically figure out how to get their best players on your best players. That's how good teams play football. You're expected to show up against those teams in the same way that, you know, Eagle defense, the Chiefs were built to beat that Eagle defense with the speed that they had on the boundary with Tyreek Hill. Mm-hmm. And the Eagles were able to handle that. That's what you're supposed to do against good teams, you know?
Is democracy in danger or decline? Condoleezza Rice, William Galston, and Carlos Gutierrez and others take on this question in the fall edition of The Catalyst, a journal of ideas from the Bush Institute. Surveys show Americans place less trust in institutions like the media and business. Others contend America has faced far more challenging periods and emerged strong. Leading policymakers, Bush Institute experts, and respected journalists take on this debate. Read about it at bushcenter.org/catalyst.
as we move forward through the season, it's going to be a storyline to watch with what Zeke is going to, how Zeke is going to react to this. And you saw Deion Sanders criticizing him on NFL Network, and it was justifiably so. And like you said, with the regression, with the offensive line doesn't look the same, despite the fact that they have a lot of key components from last year. It's still not exactly the same, and we'll see how that goes moving forward. Dak isn't exactly, I think Dak is kind of the same Dak as last year, not necessarily taking a step forward, taking a step back. And you look at that secondary got completely roasted by Emmanuel Sanders, Demaryius Thomas, so on and so forth. And we talked about that too, how they have to replace 2,800 snaps in that defense, replacing veterans with rookies. So those surprises aren't a surprise at all for anybody that was really paying attention. So definitely something to look forward to for Eagles fans. Redskins versus Rams. Rams stayed in that game for a good portion, and Redskins didn't look all that great, man. I didn't see a whole lot of the game. I'm interested to see if you saw anything from it necessarily to take away from it for the gentle listeners here.
Because we faced the Redskins in week one, there's not much more we can say about them versus what we saw, you know, in week two against an LA Rams team that has gaps in a lot of places, and they just did well to, you know, attack the deficiencies on that roster. I think kind of the overarching story to be told about Washington is that they don't really scare me. In the sense that, sure, I mean, we've already played them in Washington, so check that off. They'll come, you know, to Philadelphia in the middle of the season. Who knows where the records will be and what the state of those teams will be. And, you know, maybe, you know, knowing that Washington's team, they'll be scrappy. They'll show up a fight. They've got some good pieces. You know, they're not, by no means a bad team. But I don't watch this Washington team. And kind of similarly, as I was speaking about the, you know, what happens when good teams play good teams with Dallas and Denver, this isn't a Washington team where I say, okay, they can consistently put together enough good performances to threaten this division. You know, I don't think that they, in the beginning of the season, you could have sold me on it if we saw Kirk Cousins really take over the offense and that it wasn't just Sean McVay magic. After two games, I think we can comfortably say that Sean McVay was a huge part of Kirk Cousins' success, that he, outside of that system, has taken a big step back, which is, you know, we could have anticipated. There was hope, but, you know, that makes sense. And so Washington isn't a team that, even if they come to Philadelphia and they give us, you know, tough four quarters and, you know, maybe, you know, God forbid we drop that game, Washington, I don't see them stringing together enough victories against consistently good teams because they've got a tough schedule like everybody else in the NFC East in order to threaten this division. They just don't scare me.
Ben, I'm going to ask you right now, all right, are the Eagles winning this division or not?
As of right now, I'll tell you very, very comfortably that the Eagles look like the best team in the division so far. I'm going to say that Wentz looks like the best quarterback in the division so far. I'll say that there is no better unit in this division than the front seven of the Philadelphia Eagles. That's including Dallas's offensive line. That's including the secondary of the New York Giants. I think the best unit is the front seven of the Philadelphia Eagles. What it comes down to, and we talked about this streak of games coming up, these six games for Philadelphia. With the injuries incurred now, especially in the secondary, which was already a shakier part of the Eagles team, you know, if McLeod, because we've heard the reports that McLeod and Watkins, both with hamstring issues, might be missing a few weeks. You know, it's kind of touch and go when it comes to hamstring injuries. And the last thing you want to do is rush in a guy and then have him re-injure the hamstring, and now you've got a season-long problem. If the Eagles can hold down the fort against beatable opponents with injuries in the secondary, talking about Ronald Darby, McLeod, Watkins, and they can come out of this six-game streak with a 6-2 sort of a look, right? You know, 5-3 is kind of shaky because the schedule gets tough in the second half. Obviously, you know, a six-game run, 7-1 is possible. That'd be ideal. It's possible. If they can put together that good of a streak, you can see them putting a distance out in front in this division that'll be very tough for teams to surmount, especially because they face Dallas twice at the end of the season. So if the Eagles can go 6-2 and then just split with Dallas, right? You've already got three division wins. Assumingly, if you're going, you know, 6-1 in this stretch, you've probably beaten the Giants and the Redskins as well. That's 4-2 in the division. That should clinch it. So this upcoming streak of winnable games with an injury depleted secondary is really crucial for Philadelphia.
And looking at it in the morning light, the loss to the Chiefs doesn't look, you know, because we were frustrated yesterday, obviously, because, you know, not everything goes your way. The running game is always going to be an issue this year. But when you look at it, we played a very good Chiefs team against one of the toughest environments in the NFL and stuck with them for four quarters. And it got out of hand a little bit, but we got right back in it, showed some really good toughness as a team. So, yeah, I think the needle is moving up on this team. I don't think last year that we compete like that against a Chiefs team
right.
like this.
Absolutely. You know? And an important note is you have a lot of Cowboys fans saying, okay, we went into a very tough place to play on the road against an AFC West team, and we also lost in that game, and it doesn't really, you know, it's a out-of-conference away game, so it doesn't really count much for playoff seeding.
Their entire team quit. Their defense right. quit. Their star running back quit.
Absolutely. And right now, you know, going through the Giants tape, I can say that out of eight quarters, I think the Dallas offense has looked, you know, adept or active or passable for 2.5. Mm. I mean, the first quarter and a half of that Giants game, they were not generating consistent offense whatsoever. I mean, they have not looked good. 1-1 is 1-1. I'll give you that. A division win is a division win. Sure, take it. But they haven't looked sharp, and there's no way around that.
So we're going to be talking about more of the NFC East, of course, as we go through the season. As we close this show, we wanted to make sure that we mentioned to you guys that if you go to the Locked On Eagles iTunes page, leave a review, leave your Twitter handle in there. Hopefully you give us 5 stars. Hopefully we've earned that. What you're doing when you do that is you're entering a chance to win a PFF Edge subscription for free. We're giving away one away each week. So go to iTunes, go to Locked On Eagles, leave a review, leave your Twitter handle, and you enter to win that PFF Edge subscription. To close this up, we're going to be looking forward towards next year, and we're going to be talking about our weekly pick a prospect. Ben, I'll toss it to you first, because the guy I want to talk about, like, has my whole heart, and I want to leave the show on a good note with me in a happy mood. So let's go with you first, Ben. Who do you have for pick a prospect?
Yeah, man, I'm excited for yours, but I'm going to go with what I think is a very eagerly sort of pick. And it might be, I think I'll start with this. I think wide receiver is a sneakier need than we think it might be right now, because Alshon Jeffrey's deal is obviously up at the end of this year, and the hope is that he gets involved enough with the offense and feels positively enough about the direction of Philadelphia that he wants to stay for multiple years and help lead this team to a championship. You know, God forbid if that doesn't happen, then you've got a big hole to fill and it becomes a bigger need. But even beyond Jeffrey, you've got Nelson Agholor will be entering the last year of his contract in 2018. You've got Torrey Smith, which is, you know, 2 more years on the contract, but they're both essentially 1 year deals where there's really no harm and no foul if he's cut. And so right now, you know, the safest long-term prospect on the Philadelphia Eagles wide receiver roster is Mac Hollins, right? Which obviously Mac Hollins is a fourth round selection. Pair that with the fact that you're probably going to be moving on from Darren Sproles at the end of this season. You know, he's old, he's at the end of his contract, you know, he's probably facing retirement, and you don't really have that elite punt returner that you've grown accustomed to. And I want to talk about Dante Pettis, man, the wide receiver out of Washington, right, who recently, you know, tied, was it a Pac-12 record for punt returns, or is it all NCAA?
He is bringing that special teams juice, bro. Yeah. I don't care what the record is.
No, absolutely. So Pettis has had three straight games with a punt return touchdown. He's got, you know, he's not the greatest athlete when you watch him, but you can just tell that he's got a great feel for how to you know, see the field, and he's got excellent work through his cuts, nice vision. He's just a good punt returner. You know, you don't break records without being one, despite the athleticism. On tape as a wide receiver, he's got a lot of Jordan Matthews to him. And we know that Wentz liked Jordan Matthews, and that Jordan Matthews excelled in those areas that Wentz liked to attack, that intermediate level of the field. Pettis has a lot of route running savvy to him. He's really good at getting open, and he understands throwing windows. He understands zone coverages. He knows how to create space for his quarterback. Now, unlike Matthews, Pettis has modeled really good hands. He's a very consistent catcher, and he can catch away from his frame and adjust to the football really, really well. Now, again, similar to Matthews, the athleticism isn't overwhelming. The long speed isn't, you know, particularly good. The frame is relatively average. I think Pettis is about 6'1", you know, a buck 90. He's not a terribly large guy, but he just clearly understands how to get open. And he's a very consistent, reliable target, which is a good thing to have in this offense. We saw it work for a while with Matthews. You couple that sort of an impact with the special teams value, and that's a very Philadelphia Eagles sort of pick. He's a day three guy. You could probably get him at the same spot you got Mac Hollins. I'd say even a little bit later, because the athletic profile isn't as good. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously if he keeps doing great stuff because he's playing well, then maybe that stock goes up. But Dante Pettis in round four just feels Philadelphia Eagles, man.
Yeah, and who would you rather have at the catch point and after the catch? Jordan Matthews or Dante Pettis? Who do you think over a projection has a better skill set leading for those things?
Hey, I mean, it's a little unfair because we know what happened with Jordan Matthews. He did have after the catch potential coming out of Vanderbilt, and then it didn't really go anywhere in the NFL.
But Jordan Matthews also didn't have that production in the punt return game right. either. It wasn't like a natural feel for him.
Right. No. Yeah, so no, I'm definitely taking Pettis. Now, if Pettis doesn't, you know, Pettis, I don't think will ever be a great, like, you know, tackle breaker or open space elusiveness sort of guy. I think his best yak opportunities will come, like, you know, on that 2 yard drag route where he catches it with 6 yards of space in front of him. Right. You know, he's not necessarily going to like muscle through guys directly after the catch or anything. But no, I think, yeah, I agree with you. I'll take Pettis after the catch. Obviously, Jordan Matthews, a more polished product for sure than Pettis, but you can see the technical skill, the technician's aspect of Pettis there that kind of reminds me a bit of Jordan Matthews.
I love the fit. I love the player. I'm going to go with another guy.
Yep, give it to me, baby.
I'm going to go with Tennessee running back John Kelly. Look, I am a running back junkie. And if you follow me on Twitter, then you know I'm always posting, you know, videos and whatnot of different running backs. And it was kind of how I chipped my teeth in the scouting academy. John Kelly. Okay, so you talk about Saquon Barkley and Darius Geis. And to be fair, Ronald Jones II, who our friend Jimmy Kemsky profiled in his five prospects to watch, profiled him on there. So go check that piece out. It's excellent. Jimmy does good work. So he profiled Ronald Jones II on there, who I believe is going to be, at the end of it, a top tier back that's going to get taken in the first round. Seeing as I don't necessarily, with some of the roster deficiencies that we have, the offensive tackle need that we're probably going to have going into the season, just the value of that position, I want someone that we can get later on because this is going to be a crowded running back class. So you get past those top three, and I start to look at guys like LJ Scott, who I also like. But look, John Kelly, his leg drive, his balance, the way he closes games, and contributes in the passing game as well. And, you know, they had that game against Florida where at the end on third down, he had a crucial drop. But other than that, he's been real steady in the passing game. And I'll pull up his stats right now, man. So he didn't get a lot of work with Alvin Kamara and them still trying Hurd for most of the season at Tennessee last year. But when he did, 98 carries, 630 yards for 5 touchdowns, plus 6 receptions, 51 yards in the passing game. This year, as their feature back, through 3 games, 56 carries, 349 yards, 6.2 average, 5 touchdowns, also 16 receptions for 191 yards. This seems like a guy that can contribute in a multitude of ways and is going to get you extra yards with his... Dude, he sheds contact so beautifully, and it reminds me of when we had Matt Waldman on, and Matt Waldman talked about Samaje Perine melting contact like butter on a cast iron pan. That is John Kelly this year for me. He brings that type of dynamic to where we can put an offense on his shoulders, give him 25 carries and 5 catches, give him 30 touches a game, and take some of the pressure off of Wentz because you've got a bell cow back that can get it done. Ben, what have you seen from John Kelly?
Yeah, no, I mean, I haven't given John Kelly the full look yet, but I'll tell you right now, the one thing that's going to make John Kelly a hot commodity once people really start breaking down these prospects come the end of the year, and that's low tread. I mean, we hear it with running backs every single year. You talked about the fact that Kelly didn't see as many reps with Alvin Kamara and Jalen Hurd there in Tennessee. He's going to come with limited reps on his tires. And when you're putting him up against some backs like, you know, Royce Freeman, who's had a ridiculous number of touches and carries over his career, and a Saquon Barkley, who's seeing, you know, a regular 20, 25 touches in this.
Same with Geis and same with LJ Scott. A lot of carries, yeah.
Right. And Geis kind of does have that added advantage of not being the starter. This is his first year as the starter, and so he may get a little bit more of that, but I think Kelly's really going to be a guy who's going to benefit from that narrative. So no, I've heard so many good things about John Kelly. I've been away from running backs for the past couple months. I've been going through the defensive guys, getting my preseason and my 2016 evals done on those guys. But Kelly's been popping for a lot of people.
Well, ask your boy over there at NDT Scouting.
Oh, yeah.
I know Joe Marino is a fan, so yeah. Ask him about him and get edumacated on our boy John Kelly from Tennessee, future Eagles Hall of Fame running back.
Okay. Joe's a big Dante Pettis guy too, man. We should just keep plagiarizing his work.
We need to bring Joe on, is what.
Oh, yeah, good call.
Well, we might get exposed for that. Okay, so tomorrow we are going to be previewing the Giants-Eagles game. I think we're doing a crossover. Ben, you were setting that up earlier today, is that correct?
Yeah, scheduling is still in the works, so no promises. But hopefully Art Stapleton of Locked On Giants, who's a class act, great dude, been in this game for a while now. Hopefully he'll be coming on. We'll be able to get his perspective on the Giants season. Hopefully he doesn't listen to this podcast. Otherwise, he might be a little upset with us. But that's okay. We won't laugh about the Giants as much when he's on, out of respect.
No, we will. So if you want to hear me and Ben laugh at the Giants to the host of Locked On Giants, you got to keep it locked on here on Locked On Eagles. Fly, Eagles, fly.
Is democracy in danger or decline? Condoleezza Rice, William Galston, and Carlos Gutierrez and others take on this question in the fall edition of The Catalyst, a journal of ideas from the Bush Institute. Surveys show Americans place less trust in institutions like the media and business. Others contend America has faced far more challenging periods and emerged strong. Leading policymakers, Bush Institute experts, and respected journalists take on this debate. Read about it at bushcenter.org/catalyst.